everybody, to another episode of Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. My name is Tom Caldwell, and I am here in the lovely home of our co-host, Brandon Shimatala. We are live and in person. We're doing something a little bit different. Welcome to the show, Brandon.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to see you again. It's been so long since we've talked and seen each other. It's been a long time.
Yeah. We actually, we're both on a day off on a Friday, and we went out for lunch together, and we're spending way too much time in the same room. It's weird because so much of our production is done on the internet. And we want to say hello to Chris Haig, our foreign correspondent over in England. He will be joining us later with a summary of Juno and the Paycock, which is our film of the day.
Wait, you can't say dirty words like that.
Paycock.
Shh!
This is... that. What is the word? It's peacock with the accent on it, the Irish accent, I think, is what they're doing here. This is how they would have said peacock, because Juno refers to her husband, Captain Jack.
No, the woman was Juno.
Right, Juno is the woman.
Yeah.
And she calls him, she says he gallivants around the town like a peacock. That's where I think the paycock comes from. But it's just the same word as peacock, as the big bird that we see at the zoo, and it's just their pronunciation of it.
Okay, these people had such a thick accent, it was so hard to understand. They said peacock? I totally thought they said peanut butter sandwich.
Yeah. You and your food. This was a challenging movie to watch.
Mostly for the subtitles. Like, well, not the subtitles, because you didn't have subtitles.
We can spend lots of time talking about the film. Do you have any background you want to go through on the film?
Yeah, we should get to that in a second here. So, yeah, it was an interesting little film. So let's do the history of the film first, and then we'll cut to our good friend Chris, the foreign correspondent, with his summary of the film. So Juno and the Paycock is a 1930 British film written and directed by Hitchcock, starring Barry Fitzgerald, Marie O'Neill, Edward Chapman, and Sarah Allgood. The film was based on the successful play of the same name by Sean O'Casey. Sounds Irish. Hmm. Sean O'Casey's play was first performed at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin in March of 1924. In November the following year, the Irish Players brought Juno and the Paycock to London, where it played for over 250 performances. Although Casey had deep reservations about allowing his work to be filmed, Ivor Novello and Adrian Brunel persuaded him to visit Elstree Studios, where he met with Hitchcock whilst he was filming Champagne. Over the following months, the two met several times, and Hitchcock was not only able to secure O'Casey's approval to film Juno, but also coaxed the playwright into writing a new scene for the beginning of the film. The screen adaptation, which was relatively faithful to the play, was written by Alma Revel and provided her with her first official script credit on a Hitchcock film. And for those that don't know, that is Mrs. Hitchcock.
Right. And how can you not know that if you follow our show?
Yes.
You should know that much.
And again, I forgot to mention at the beginning, these notes are taken from the Hitchcock Zone as well as Wikipedia. Hitchcock filmed a faithful reproduction of the play using few of the directorial touches he had incorporated in his previous films. He often asked cinematographer Jack Cox to hold the camera for long single shots. He was eager to have a scene set outside the flat inserted into the film, and after permission from O'Casey, he added a pub scene. O'Casey made quite an impression on Hitchcock and was the inspiration for the Prophet of Doom in the diner in The Birds.
Ooh.
So when we get there, we'll have to remember that when we get to The Birds. Sarah Allgood reprised her role as Juno from the play, and Barry Fitzgerald made his film debut here. Now, similarly, the songs in the film are deliberately the kind of fake Irish music hall ones popular in America. If you're Irish, come into the parlor, where in O'Casey's original, their meaning is different. Jockster can't remember the words of She Is Far From the Land, Thomas More's plangent song in memory of his close friend Robert Emmet, another martyr of an earlier revolution. Filming took place during November and December 1929, predominantly on a single-room set, which that is interesting because most of this film takes place in this one apartment, so you can tell that it really was based on a play.
Right.
Hitchcock later wrote in 1937 about how the off-screen sounds of the funeral scene were achieved. In Juno and the Paycock, we wanted to get over a a medley of noises. The machine guns that were firing down the street, the tinny note of a cheap gramophone playing in the room, the chatter of other people in the room, the tread, tread, tramp, tramp of a funeral procession going by. The funeral was that of a man whose death John Laurie had encompassed, and the scene was a close-up of him by the fire and the effect these various blending noises had on him. So we filled the studio with the noises. In one corner was a crowd of people talking in low voices. In another, half a dozen people marking time. In a third, a stagehand was beating a sofa with two canes to make the machine gun fire. But we couldn't get a record of the tune we needed, so the fourth corner was filled by the property man singing the tune through a megaphone. But that just sounded like a man singing, not like a cheap gramophone, so we clipped a clothes peg on his nose. And the scene reproduced perfectly. Now, as far as the actors in the film, Barry Fitzgerald, as the orator, was an Irish stage, film, and television actor. In a career spanning almost 40 years, he appeared in such notable films as Bringing Up Baby from 1938, The Long Voyage Home, 1940, How Green Was My Valley from 1941, None But the Lonely Heart from 1944, and The Quiet Man in 1952. For 1944's Going My Way, he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, but he was also simultaneously nominated for the Academy Award for Best Actor. And this is the only film that he appeared in for Hitchcock. However, he also appeared in a 1955 episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents as Harold Stretch Sears in the episode Santa Claus and the 10th Avenue Kid. Marie O'Neill, as Maisie Madigan, was born Mary Agnes Allgood at 40 Middle Abbey Street, Dublin. She was one of eight children of compositor George and French polisher Margaret Allgood. She was known as Molly. Her father was sternly Protestant and against all music, dancing, and entertainment, and her mother a strict Catholic. After her father died in 1896, she was placed in an orphanage. She was apprenticed to a dressmaker. One of the Allgood's brothers, Tom, became a Catholic priest. Under her professional name, Mary O'Neill, she appeared in films from 1930 to 53, including Hitchcock's film version of Sean O'Casey's play Juno and the Peacock. She made her American debut in New York in 1914 in the play General John Reagan at the Houston Theater. This is her only Hitchcock appearance. And Edward Chapman, as Captain Boyle, was an English actor who starred in many films and television programs, but is chiefly remembered as Mr. Wilfred Grimsdale, the officious, superior, and comic foil to Norman Wisdom's character of Pitkin in many of his films from the late 50s and 60s. Chapman was born in Harrogate, West Riding of Yorkshire, England. On leaving school, he became a bank clerk, but later began his stage career with Ben Greet's company in June of 1924 at the Repertory Theatre, Nottingham, playing Gecko in Georges de Maurier's Trilby. He made his first London stage appearance at the Court Theatre in August of 1925, playing the Reverend Septimus Tudor in The Farmer's Wife. Among dozens of stage roles that followed, he played Bonaparte to Margaret Rawlings Josephine in Napoleon at the Embassy Theatre in September of 1934, and in 1928 he attracted the attention of Hitchcock, who gave him the role of the Peacock in the film Juno and the Peacock. In the same year, he also made an appearance in Cast. He had a role in The Citadel in 1938 and appeared alongside George Formby in the Ealing Studios comedy Turned Out Nice Again in 1941. During the Second World War, he took a break from acting and joined the Royal Air Force. After training, he was posted to 129, the 129th Squadron as an intelligence officer. This Spitfire Squadron was based at West Hampnett and Debden. Sorry for my mispronunciation on these. The squadron was heavily engaged in combat during this period, and many of Chapman's fellow squadron mates were killed in action. He will show up again in Murder and The Skin Game. And the last actor we'll talk about is Sidney Morgan as Joxer. He was an English film director, screenwriter, producer, and actor. He directed 45 films between 1914 and 1937, and as an actor, this was his only Hitchcock appearance. And this film has no Hitchcock cameo.
Even Hitchcock didn't want to be in this.
Yes.
Juno and the Peacock plot summary. In the slums of Dublin during the Irish Civil War, Captain Boyle lives in a two-room tenement flat with his wife Juno and their two young children, Mary and Johnny. Juno has dubbed her husband the Peacock because she thinks him as youthful and vain as a peacock. Juno works while the captain loafs around the flat when not drinking up the family's meagre finances at the neighbourhood pub. Daughter Mary has a job but is on strike against the victimisation of a co-worker. Son Johnny has become a semi-invalid after losing an arm and severely injuring his hip in a fight with the Black and Tans during the Irish War of Independence. Although Johnny has taken the anti-treaty side during the continuing Irish Civil War, he has recently turned in a fellow Irish Republican Army, or IRA member, to the Irish Free State Police, who subsequently kill him. The Peacock tells his friend Joxer of his disgust at the informer, unaware that his son's responsible. The IRA suspect Johnny and order him to report to them for questioning. He refuses, protesting that his wounds show he has done his bit for Ireland. Mary is courted by Jerry Devine, who she leaves for Charlie Bentham, who whisks her away after telling Mary's family that the captain is to receive an inheritance. The elated captain borrows money against the as-yet-unreceived inheritance and spends it freely on new furniture and a Victrola. Family friends are invited to an impromptu party at the once shabby tenement. The captain soon learns that the inheritance has been lost because Bentham made an error in drafting the will. The captain keeps the bad news a secret until creditors show up. Even Joxer turns on the captain and gleefully spreads the news of the non-existent inheritance to creditors. The furniture store repossesses the furniture. The tailor demands money for new clothes. Pub owner Mrs. Madigan takes the Victrola to cover the captain's bar tab. The worst is yet to come, however. Mary reveals that she has shamed the family by becoming pregnant by Charles, who had disappeared after his blunder was discovered. Her former fiancé, Jerry, proclaims his love for Mary and offers to marry her until he learns of her pregnancy. While his parents are absent dealing with the situation, Johnny is arrested by the IRA and his body is later found riddled with bullets. Realising that their family has been destroyed, Mary declares, "It's true. There is no God." Although completely shattered, Juno shushes her daughter, saying that they will need both Christ and the Blessed Virgin to deal with their grief. Alone, however, she laments her son's fate before the religious statues in the family's empty tenement, deciding that Boyle will remain useless, and leaves with Mary.
Quickly, the historical background here. Juno and the Peacock is set against the political and social background of Ireland in the 20s. After centuries of unrest, the Irish Free State was created by the 1921 Anglo-Irish Agreement. Sinn Féin, the dominant political party in Ireland, eventually proclaimed independence from British rule and formed its own government, an act that eventually led to civil war. So the character Johnny Boyle is a quartermaster in the Republican Association, which, not explicitly stated, but this organization would evolve into the Irish Republican Army. So, I'm not a big history buff, you know, this is important to read to kind of know where they're coming from, because in the opening scenes of the film, they're encountering what's called the Easter Weekend Rebellion, where the men are protesting on the street, like they're having a rally, and there's actually a volley of machine gun fire opened onto the crowd, and they all rush into the bar for safety and drinks. And I think that's when Johnny was injured. He lost his arm and he took a bullet or two. And that's sort of it's a very violent, you know, situation that they're living in. This is lower class Dublin that they are. This is a tragic comedy. There's a lot of bad things going on to these people. And the biggest point in the beginning of the film, or the biggest turning for the plot, is the fact that a lawyer visits them and says that Captain Jack inherited a £2,000 inheritance from the estate of a distant cousin. And so this is where the family, they get their joy and their inspiration, and they go out and they buy furniture for the flat. Like, they buy all this on credit ahead of getting the actual money.
Bad idea.
Yeah. And their big purchase is a gramophone.
Mm-hmm.
So they buy this gramophone. The salesman throws in a free record for them. And they're very excited. And they promise to pay for everything. But the money falls through.
Mm-hmm.
The money falls through because there are too many of the cousins show up to claim the money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... it wasn't really explained, but I think the lawyer kind of disappeared also.
Yeah, he did.
And
because they show that scene where they were painting over his name on the door,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So a lot of hope, and they're celebrating the money, and then suddenly the money is gone again.
The money they never had. But not only did the lawyer disappear, but he also impregnated their daughter,
mm-hmm.
and took off. So their daughter's like, you know, without. Husband, like she's gonna have this child out of wedlock and whatnot, but you know, it was weird because it was interesting to see these people having no money, and it was like really, it was well portrayed on screen,
yeah.
that they had no money. Like, you know, they went to the bar, they had no money, so somebody else bought them a drink. They went home, they didn't really have food. The guy was trying to be proud. I didn't quite understand why, but he's like, no, I'll take no breakfast. And then when she left, he like ate it anyways. Mm-hmm. I don't know, like. So I didn't quite get the motivation behind that, but he had his friends over for tea and food as well, and they couldn't really afford it, so the wife was upset, you know, things like that. But
Captain Jack is a bit of a ne'er-do-well. Somebody showed up and was talking about there was work available.
Right, yeah.
And then Jack starts complaining about his sore legs, yes. and how he can't work, and the wife doesn't believe any of this. And Jack and his buddy that were at the bar... Their excitement is they're going to go to the house because the wife isn't home to nag them.
Yes.
And then they get to the house and Juno shows up and nags them, I guess. So it's a very simple life that these people live. But it ends up that the money falls through. The men come and repossess all the furniture. A lot of tragic turns at the end here. It's Johnny that ends up dying, correct?
Yeah, so they have this son. Now, I didn't get that his arm was lost at the beginning of the film. I got it was some other event. And so I had a little bit of trouble with this plot point in the film and trying to tie it in. So they had this son who, you know, he lost an arm and he was shot and he was like, he's like healing from this. He's healed now. I got the impression that he's all healed now. But... there's these, he's also melancholy throughout the film. Like there's this really neat shot of that Hitchcock does where the camera just slowly pans in on him. He's sitting there thinking, and everybody else is talking in the background. And there's another scene where he, like, freaks out because he thinks he sees this ghost of this friend. And it slowly dawned on me that I think he killed this friend.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that it's clear in the film. Maybe I just missed something, because I had a really tough time with the accents in this film. Like, I didn't have my iPad on or anything, and I was having a tough time following along the words.
We were saying how it was hard to hear what they were saying because of the quality of the film.
Right, yeah, the DVD...
Like, the audio quality was poor. Well, it's an old production, and
yeah.
they were limited in what they could do at the time. And then... even if you could hear what they're saying, you couldn't understand what they're saying because the dialect was so heavy,
right?
And their word choices and their word usage, like, it was very difficult. We talked about, you know, if I'd had subtitles, I would have turned them on, kind of thing.
Yeah, I tried to turn my subtitles on, and then I realized my disc didn't have any.
Yeah. It's a challenging film to watch, and it's a dark story. Like, there's nothing really happy that happens to these people, and. It's a tragic comedy, like I said, and it's a bit of a challenge to get all the way through this film.
Mm-hmm. See, I didn't have a tough time getting through the film myself, but I had a tough time kind of understanding everything that was going on and getting context for everything. Like, at the end, after they've had everything confiscated by
the furniture company.
The furniture company comes and takes the furniture. Yeah. The son is still sitting there. The mother and the daughter go to find the dad, and the son's left behind. And these dudes in suits come up, and they're like, they take the son away and kill him as like revenge for killing this other person. And so the ending of the film is a real downer ending, right? But
right.
Again, I kind of had trouble following along with the plot, and I think that the limitation is because of the accents.
you really have to be able to follow the war, the Civil War stuff that was going on, and the men that show up at the end and take him away and kill him would have been, you know, related to that Civil War. And it's, yeah, it's a very tragic ending. Mm-hmm. And the whole film ends with Juno crumbling with grief. Like, it's a pretty sad ending to the film.
Mm-hmm. People really don't have much to say about this film. I mean, like, Donald Spoto in The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, 50 Years of His Motion Pictures, he has one paragraph. He says, "Also in 1930, Hitchcock and his wife Alma Revel were assigned to adapt, film, and edit Sean O'Casey's play Juno and the Paycock about an impoverished family during the Dublin uprisings. This was not a work of his choice. He dispatched it perfunctorily according to his contractual obligations, and it has, as he told Francois Truffaut, nothing to do with cinema, or at least nothing to do with his cinema."
Right.
That's the only entry that's in that book. You've got the Truffaut and Hitchcock book there. Is there anything else in there?
Hitchcock says in the Truffaut interviews how he didn't feel he didn't really want to make a picture of this play. He had read the play a lot of times. He couldn't see any way of narrating it into cinematic form. He says that it is an excellent play. He liked the story. He liked the mood and the characters. The blend of humor and tragedy was good. And as a matter of fact, I had O'Casey in mind when I showed a bum in a cafe announcing the end of the world in The Birds, which is a nice foreshadowing. He photographed the play as imaginatively as possible. From a creative viewpoint, it was not a pleasant experience. The film got good notices. This is Hitchcock talking.
Mm-hmm.
But he was actually ashamed because it had nothing to do with cinema. The critics praised the picture, and I had the feeling I was dishonest, that I had stolen something. So he didn't really feel that it was his creation because he was recreating the film, right?
The play.
Oh, the play, yeah.
Well, that's interesting because a lot of his films were based on plays or stories or stuff, so does he not take credit for anything?
Well,
you know?
Yeah. I guess maybe this was a version of... This was a film where it really is just the play being done on camera.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's very... There's the scene in the apartment is the majority of the film, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have some activity in the pub, but it really is a play done on camera. So he probably felt like he didn't really have much creativity in the production.
Mm-hmm. And then Alfred Hitchcock, The Complete Films by Paul Duncan, also only has one paragraph, so I'll read it here. He spent a little more time on Juno and the Paycock in 1930, an adaptation of the famed Sean O'Casey play about an Irish family who are told they are to get a big inheritance and are corrupted by the wealth. O'Casey wrote an additional scene, but it's basically a film of the stage play using the original cast of the successful Abbey Theatre production. Hitchcock would later return to the problem of filming a stage play with rope and Dial M for Murder. And that is an interesting comparison to think about this in the context of Rope as well.
Right.
You know, because Rope is basically a one-room play.
Yeah.
So we'll probably compare that more when we get to Rope, which is our favorite Hitchcock
film.
Yeah,
and it was in Juno and the Paycock, it does happen very long scenes in one location, similar to how Rope is produced.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, again, like, we're watching films like Juno and the Paycock. It's part of our podcast, and we realize the importance of watching these difficult films. They're not popular films. You and I both said we probably wouldn't watch this one again. We wouldn't necessarily push our friends to watch the film. But it is an important piece in the history of Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
An important piece to have experienced, for sure.
But we're watching it so you don't have to.
Yeah, we're watching it for you. My rating out of 5 is I gave this 1 out of 5 repossessed gramophones.
Nice. I'll give this 1.5 drinks.
1.5 shots that someone else paid for.
Yes.
After you ordered them and promised to pay for them.
But then couldn't pay for them.
And couldn't pay for them. And yes. Yeah, an interesting film, but yeah, definitely a challenge to get through, I think.
I mean, like, we're only doing like a 15-minute podcast here, but I mean, I got 2 books of Hitchcock, and there's 2 paragraphs combined
on
this film. Like, people don't have much to say on this one, so I think we've bled this film dry of its green blood.
We've shot all the machine gun bullets into a crowd of political speakers that we can on this one. So we'll move on. How do Brandon, how can people get hold of you if they're interested in Star Trek?
You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me on Trek FM with two podcasts. One is called The Edge, which is a Star Trek Discovery podcast, and the other is called Warp 5, which is a Star Trek Enterprise podcast. And if you like old films, every once in a while we're doing a thing called Movie Night on the Warp 5 podcast, because on Star Trek Enterprise they would watch movies for Movie Night and they would talk about them. They didn't really show them on screen, but they did, oh, we watched this and we watched that, and you know, so we're going through these old films. So we've covered the old French film, The Wages of Fear. We're going to be covering the three Frankenstein films with Boris Karloff pretty soon here. So if you like that, you know, you can keep an eye on the feeds for that there. Our good friend, foreign correspondent, Chris Haig, you can find him at Higher_Boy. And that's on Twitter. He's got a podcast called North by Nerd West, with his good friend Emma. And Tom, where can people find you when you're not trying to get free drinks from people?
I do that a lot. Tom Caldwell 3000 on Twitter, the Tom Caldwell on Instagram. We have a pretty good following on Facebook for our podcast, Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. We're also on Twitter, and we encourage people to get involved and give feedback. Follow us, listen to all the old shows. We're up to, what, 16 episodes now?
Something like that. 17, yeah, 18, it's been, 16?
I think we're 13 or 14 months into the project, so it's been a really good time. We hope everyone's enjoying the shows. And if you haven't gone back to episode 1 and 2, nothing wrong with going back and listening to the whole series. Give you something to do in all your spare time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you found us in our master feed, like, we're in the Fandom Podcast master feed, and they're available on Twitter at FanPod Network. We also have our own independent feed as well, which you can find all of the old episodes, and including our episode 0, which is where we introduced ourselves on the Fandom Podcast Network, which we're recording this on April 13th. It was basically a year ago that we started. It was the last Sunday in April 2017 that we released our first three episodes. So we're almost at a year right now, so it's a lot of fun. Don't forget to check out as well all the wonderful shows that we have on Fandom Podcast Network. There's a lot of great podcasts there. And also be sure to check out our good friends Annie and Catherine with their podcast, Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast, where they're going through the episodes of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents show, not one at a time, but, you know, they're kind of going all over the place in order from all seven seasons. But that show is a lot of fun. And between the two podcasts, you get a near comprehensive look at Mr. Hitchcock's career.
For sure.
So tune in next time, where we have the wonderful film Murder from 1930. And if you feel eager, I'm going to try my best to find a copy of it, but Hitchcock also directed the German language version of this film, which is called Mary. So he directed two versions of the film, one in English and one in German. So if you feel eager and can find it, tweet me and let me know where you found the German version, because I can't find it anywhere. So I'm digging deep, trying to find it.
It'll be on GermanTube.
GermanTube. You German.
Yes.
We'd also like to thank our good friend Jason Cullimore for creating our awesome new theme song. Jason Cullimore is an award-winning Canadian composer, and you can find his work on his website, jasoncullimore.com. That's C-U-L-L-I-M-O-R-E. And he's on Instagram, and you can find him as well on SoundCloud. Thank you so much, Jason. We love the new theme song.
So thanks, everybody. And as we traditionally like to end the show, I wish you good evening.
Good evening.